everybody. Thanks for coming out on a Friday afternoon. It's especially nice, I have to say, in my capacity as director of the MFA program, to see so many MFAs here. You know that I would always like to see you at everything. We've had our little talk about that. But anyway, I'm happy to see you today, and I won't harp on that topic. Today we have one of our alumni with us, Sarah Beth Childers, to read from her new book. And there's not just one copy of it. That's just a representative copy. There's a whole box of them over here, so please do think about purchasing a book. I told Sarah Beth this was going to be a minimalist intro because the little bio on here is so delightful. Like, I don't really know what else to say after Victorian novels and Chopin nocturnes and Boston Terriers and cats and things like that. So maybe she'll tell us about some of that after she reads, and I also hope that during a little Q&A time she might tell us about her job search experiences, which are heartening. Let's go with that. Okay, please welcome Sarah Beth Childers.
I'm going to read four short pieces. The first three are from my book, and then the last one's a new one. All right, so this is Shorn. So this one's, you're going to see this character, my pawpaw Ralph, from a couple of different perspectives. So this is, like, one of his first appearances in the book. I took a walk with my pawpaw Ralph one spring afternoon when I was 5. Because of his heart condition, pawpaw walked often, thumping along the brick streets with his prosthetic leg and metal cane. Pawpaw seemed old to me then, but he was only 62. Dark hair still covered his head. On that walk, Pawpaw and I clutched each other's hands as we plodded past a gaping pothole, an unsteady blue house with a jungle of weeds, and a driveway that seemed to angle straight up into a thatch of maples. I held Pawpaw's hand, believing he needed me for balance. He held mine to keep me from skipping off down the street. I'd been able to read badly since I was 3 and well since I was 4, and Pawpaw was proud of his first grandchild. He showcased his tiny reader for visiting cousins, handing me National Geographic and gloating as I sounded out articles about the Niangatong people in Kentucky caves. As we walked, Pawpaw pointed out road signs, business signs, names on mailboxes, and angry poster boards nailed to shabby porches. He bellowed, "Read that one, doll!" And I read, 29th Street, Gino's Pizza, the mayor is a crook. We stopped for a root beer in Ted's Imperial Lanes, a prospect I found exciting because my parents refused to take me. The inside was less spectacular than I'd hoped, a dim bowling alley full of loud, breezy-haired people with cigarettes. I clung closer to Pawpaw's polyester polo as he brought a root beer and chose a table with two sticky vinyl chairs. When Pawpaw sat, he crossed his fake leg over his real one and straightened his sock. The white nylon had slipped down the flesh-colored plastic. Then he asked me to read the names on the scoreboards. On the way back to Pawpaw's, we ambled past Sansom's used cars, and the name intrigued me, Sansom. So close to Samson, the hero in my Bible storybook, drawn with 7 long black locks and muscles that bulged under his dark red tunic. Early in Samson's story, he snarls in the picture, fists outstretched, gripping the dry jawbone of a donkey he's used to slay 1,000 Philistines. Bodies litter the sandy earth around his sandals. In a later picture, after his run-in with Delilah, Samson's hair is short and ragged, his eyes empty bruises. Feasting Philistines in gold rings and purple cloaks mock Samson as he stands, chained to the stone pillars that support the house where the laughing people sit. The Philistines should have known this was a bad idea. Samson bows his head, so shamefully bare, and prays for the strength to kill himself with the Philistine lords. Pawpaw died 3 years after that walk, and when I think about him, I often think of our journey to the bowling alley. I'm alone and happy with Pawpaw, as healthy as I ever saw him. And then this memory, that sign for Sansom's car lot, burns as clearly as Pawpaw's shiny cane, his striped polo shirt, his wavy dark hair. And behind that sign lurks a drawing of Samson. I wonder why I remember that sign so clearly, if as a 5-year-old I connected the 2 fiery dark-haired men, both of them robbed of their might. With Pawpaw's left leg, a dead thing he propped in a bedroom corner when he slept, he barely seemed the same man as that robust father in my mother's photo album, the teenage sailor in his sister's stories, who battled the Japanese in the South Pacific. But I didn't think of my pawpaw as weak. I squeezed his hand in dingy alleys because he needed me. Deprived of his sight, even Samson needed a child to guide his hands to the stone pillars. And I clung to Pawpaw because I depended on him. If a greasy person had crept after us out of that bowling alley, Pawpaw would have defended me with his cane if he had to, summoning his former strength with a prayer. Right, this is an excerpt from a longer essay called My Dead Grandmother Essay. So it had kind of a sarcastic title and a premise. So it's like some of the sections are like her soft, sweet smell which is about her like house being smelled like nicotine anyway, and like and so her like her walls were yellow, her front door was yellow. She kept trying to have a goldfish, and the water would turn yellow, and the goldfish would die. This happened 3 goldfish in a row, and finally we just told her, you're not allowed to have any more fish. But, so this is her inspiring romance with my grandfather. So you'll see Pawpaw Ralph again. Dot was married to Ralph for 13 years. My other set of grandparents have been married for over 60 years. When I was little, my family visited them in a split level we called Mama and Grandpa. Granny and Pawpaw we visited separately. Granny in her house alone. Pawpaw with his sister Anita and his mother. Granny's damn Pearl Carter, and her mustard-colored home on the other side of Huntington. When I was very little, before Pawpaw died, I like to imagine what he and Granny had been like as a couple. I knew they'd fought, she'd lied, and Ralph had screamed, angry and powerless, and finally Dot had locked him out. But I'd also heard my mother tell happier stories, how they'd smoked together on car trips with the windows rolled up. Even now, I like to imagine them, the workaholic railroad engineer with a wicked sense of humor, and Dot in her saner, more social days when she and her pastor's wife went out to lunch. Ralph and Dot were a beautiful couple. Perhaps that's why they got married. She was slim, black-haired, with a shy, bright smile and the deep tan complexion of her Cherokee mother. He had a boyish grin and dark brown waves. Once, on a visit to Pawpaw's, after he picked me up from kindergarten, I grew bored with the book I was reading, my little body stretched out across the thin brown rug. I looked up to where Pawpaw sat in his white leather chair, his prosthetic leg propped up alongside his real one as he drank a glass of iced tea and Tang and joked with his sister. I decided it was a good time to bring up Granny. I was curious to see her to hear what he'd say, and I thought he'd like to hear how his ex-wife was doing. Perhaps deep down, he loved her still. I don't remember what I told him. Seconds into my story, the room shook with Pawpaw's laughter. Granny, he crowed, gripping the chair's armrest for support. That's a great name for her. I stopped mid-sentence, confused and embarrassed, giggling as I pretended to understand the joke. But the joke was on him, at least I thought so. I knew something he didn't. Granny and Pawpaw owned matching recliners. Hers was pink and his blue. They seemed like his and hers models, like prizes they'd won together on a game show. I didn't think of the obvious. There'd probably been a sale at the Lazy Boy outlet that my mom had helped purchase both chairs. When I visited Granny or Pawpaw, I sat in the recliners. I smiled to myself, thinking of their lifelong connection, about how love could not die. When Pawpaw passed away, I told Granny all about it, though surely I knew she'd already heard. I wanted to hear her reaction. I feel like a weight has been lifted off my shoulders, she said, her tone low and solemn. She clutched a post on her porch and stared toward the flood wall. It seemed she was gazing through the concrete at the Guyandot River. I was glad. To me, this meant she still loved him. Her grieving over their lost romance had finally ended, and she felt relieved. On the car ride home, I told my mother what Granny had said, and I was confused when she rolled her eyes and sighed. A few years later, I thought I finally understood. Granny had spoken out of spite. I realize now, after 2 decades of Granny's inconsistencies, sewing dresses for my sisters and me, giving us birthday money, and then telling us to leave, the Granny statement didn't necessarily mean she loved or hated Pawpaw. She might have just said it for dramatic effect. Or maybe not. One winter day, when my mother was at work in the blouse department, Dot appeared outside the store window, pacing the street. Marcy's supervisor gave her the rest of the day off, telling her to get her mother in out of the cold. As they rode the bus home, Dot explained. She'd walked out that morning, probably out of cigarettes, and she'd heard a voice tell her Ralph was at her house. He's burned it to the ground, Marcy. We've got no place to go. She rocked back and forth on the bus seat in terror. My mother hugged her, told her nothing had happened, but Dot would not be consoled. As the bus drew nearer to their street, Dot clenched my mother's hands. She bawled with relief when she saw the house was still there. All right, then this next one, I'm reading this is a full essay. This one's called Ghost Siblings, and this is one that I think this to me is a great example of why you need to write like what you want to write when you feel it, because if I waited, I would have never been able to write this essay, because it's about this brother we sort of grew up feeling like we had, because my mom had a miscarriage like after me, so we grew up feeling like we had this like fifth sibling, and then so this is something, and then of course my brother has passed away, so now I feel like if I think of a dead brother, it's like my real dead brother, not like this one. So this is something that I could have only written at this time. All right, so ghost siblings. This first section is called Christopher Michael. I have a brother. He is dead. My 7-year-old brother painstakingly penciled these words on a horizontally rolled sheet. In between each pair of solid lines on the page, a dashed line props up the middles of the trickier letters, the cross of the T, the B's round belly. I have 3 sisters, Joshua began, before writing the sentences that must have made his first grade teacher's tight perm stand on end. A baby grew in my mother's left fallopian tube when I was 18 months old, 7 years before Joshua was born. When the tube burst, my mother plopped me into my crib and crawled to the bathtub, casting looks over her shoulder as I wailed. "That's the only time I ever let any of you cry," she tells me, proud and apologetic. My mother stared at the cracked bathroom ceiling, hoping to soak away her stabs of pain. My dad wrapped his dripping young wife in a blanket and drove her to the hospital. The doctors were shocked she was alive. Months later, when the baby should have been born, my mother grew depressed. She spent hours in her prayer closet, kneeling between a basket of baby clothes and her stained maternity dresses. Finally, revelation dawned. She tried to move on after her surgery, washing my cloth diapers and teaching Sunday school like nothing had happened, and she needed to mourn her child. To mourn properly, she needed the child's name. My mother called her obstetrician, a kind middle-aged man, and asked if he knew the sex of her baby. "I'm sorry, Marcy," he told her, "but I just can't remember." "Thank you so, so much," my mom said, beaming into the receiver. The doctor couldn't remember. It had been possible to tell. She yanked her typewriter from its ponderous black case and banged out a letter to the hospital's records department. Then she raced down our gravel driveway toward the mailbox, ignoring the sharp rocks that bit into her bare feet. Halfway to the mailbox, she stopped. She closed her eyes, face skyward, letting the wind rustle her cotton skirt and her long, curly brown hair. She ran back into the house, letters still in hand. I don't remember this, of course, but she must have headed straight for my crib. My dad was at work, and I'm sure she needed to tell someone. "It's a boy," she breathed, gathering me up, warm and pink from my nap. Her tears dotted my undershirt. "God told me his name is Christopher Michael, and my darling Sarah Beth, he looks a lot like you." As I grew, my mother and I talked more about Christopher Michael, imagining the day when we'd finally hug him in heaven. My mother was a stay-at-home mom, and the daily absence of adult conversation gave her time for prayers and dreams. She taught me to make a prayer list, the U.S. president and our church pastor at the top, then parents, siblings, grandparents, great-aunts, regular aunts and uncles, cousins, my dog and pet snail, school friends, teachers, and classmates, and teachers I hadn't forgiven. I penciled Christopher Michael into my list of siblings. When I prayed for Christopher Michael, I pictured him running down the golden streets, a smaller boy version of myself. Blue-green eyes, two skinny limbs, stick-straight honey-brown hair, a nose that should have been smaller. He probably didn't have my freckles, my dirt-brown host that budded in spring and blossomed after a day at the pool. That's one perk of a place that glows without sunshine. You can't get freckles from the glory of God. I prayed for Christopher Michael, but I didn't wish him into my life, crammed as it was with three mortal siblings. After Joshua was born, my dad converted our five-seater coupe into a six-seater sedan by buckling Jennifer and me into the front passenger seat. We had to share, even though we were the biggest. Toddler Rebecca and newborn Joshua needed their safety seats. On the ride to church, the playground, my grandparents' house, Jennifer squashed against me in her sweaty t-shirt, surrounding me with her odors of wild onions and dogs. "The seatbelt's too tight," she screamed. Without fail, I adjusted the strap. "Too loose." My mom joked, "Christopher Michael were in this car with us. She didn't know where she would put him. She said, we'd have to strap him to the roof." Christopher Michael wouldn't have fit any easier in our house, a 1,200-square-foot rancher with one bath and three small bedrooms. Rebecca's bedroom was filled with our toys and clothes. The bed Jennifer and I shared was crowded enough, and Joshua slept in a crib in the living room. Two beds by the piano would look ridiculous, and we couldn't handle another person in line for the toilet. When the family car pulled up in the driveway, my sisters and I yelled, "First on the potty!" The last girl to call dibs peed in the woods behind our house. My unborn brother was better off in his roomy mansion in heaven. I envied Christopher Michael his own gold-plated toilet, his cavernous playroom full of unimaginably exciting toys. I pictured his mansion as a fairy tale castle with stone turrets, a coat of ivy, and red geraniums bursting from window boxes. When a biblical celebrity strolled by, Christopher Michael hurried outside. "Moses, what does manna taste like? Did you see any interesting skeletons on the bottom of the Red Sea?" Christopher Michael could get immediate answers. I had to wait until heaven to find out. I envied my brother, but I pitied him too. I kept his name on my rumpled prayer list because I worried he was lonely. Alone in his ruby-studded, race car-shaped bed, he might wish a dog-scented sibling was lying beside him. This is the second section called Joy. Once a year, my mom drove to the other side of Huntington, West Virginia, toting a pitcher of water and a bouquet of roses. "We're going to see my sister," she said, smiling wistfully at me in the front seat, my sisters in the back. I hummed along to the hymns on the car radio, enjoying a seat to myself. My dad was at his parents' house with baby Joshua. My mom turned at a man-made pond that was choked with water lilies and stopped under a shady tree. Then she unfastened Rebecca from her safety seat and handed me the pitcher. While my mom kept pace with Rebecca's short legs and Jennifer scampered off to catch cicadas, I sloshed ahead down a steep ridge till I came to a small flat headstone. It was coated in mud from fresh graves. I poured the water, half on the grave, half on my socks, and my mom whipped a nylon brush from her purse and scrubbed until we could read the inscription. Glenda Joyce Hager, with birth and death dates less than a year apart. Joy died 6 years before my mother was born. Dot got up in the night to smile into the crib, and her baby wasn't breathing. She rushed Joy to the hospital, but it was too late, a fast-killing case of meningitis. A couple of weeks earlier, Dot had dressed her baby in lace and stick-on hair bows for a batch of professional photos. Joy had whimpered, then giggled as the photographer danced a stuffed bear around the camera. On Dot's birthday, days after the funeral, the prints arrived in the mail. I never heard Granny mention Joy, but my mother talked about her often. When I smacked Jennifer for knocking over my dollhouse or whined when Rebecca used my new t-shirt as a nightgown, my mother got teary-eyed. "I would have given my right arm to have a sister," she told me. "You don't realize how blessed you are. I have to wait till heaven to see mine." My mom loves her two flesh and blood brothers. Lee danced with little Marcy to Elvis and to her favorite Elvis and country western songs. One day, dressed in a white suit for the prom, Lee twirled a small muddy sister around the front yard. I found her relationship with Bobby easier to understand. They'd left a permanent brown stain on their mother's ceiling by shaking a can of Coke until it exploded. Another time, Marcy fought Bobby for a box of Cheez-Its. They punched each other and tore at the box until crushed crackers coated the floor. But neither brother could replace a sister. If Joy had lived, she might have played dolls with Marcy and tied ribbons in her hair. She might have helped her choose trendier skirts and blouses for high school and taught her to twirl a baton well enough to make the majorette squad. She definitely wouldn't have joined the military at 18, like both of her brothers, and left Marcy alone. When Marcy grew up, Joy might have taken her out to lunch and chatted with her by the pool while their children swam. Joy might have understood when Christopher Michael died in a way that no one did. Years passed before my dad could comprehend how much the loss hurt Marcy. Her brothers didn't get it. Friends at her church were worst of all. "It's just a miscarriage. The important thing is you're okay, honey. You're lucky you didn't lose a child you actually knew." This is the third section, called Christopher Michaels, plural. I did miss Christopher Michael, at least for a while. I was lonely in high school, and I envied a blonde brother-sister pair who were one grade apart, just like Christopher Michael and I might have been. When one of them dated, the boyfriend or girlfriend joined the siblings at their lunch table. When they were single, they prayed and ate happily, just the two of them. If Christopher Michael had lived, maybe I wouldn't have had to scramble for any empty foot of lunchroom bench, hoping someone would talk to me. Joshua missed Christopher Michael, too, though he didn't long for him the way my mom longed for Joy, mourning the lost sibling of his own gender. His three older sisters picked up his toys, brought him popsicles, let him ride the sled on the trek back up the snowy hill. As far as I can tell, Joshua mainly missed his brother when he wrote a play for us to perform. Jennifer could fake a man's voice decently, but Joshua tired of his ersatz male actor. Once Jennifer giggled girlishly in the middle of a line, and Joshua threw the script in frustration. He screamed, "Christopher Michael would have done it better." And here lies the blessing and the problem. Christopher Michael is our design your own family member. I could conjure up a friend for the school lunchroom, and Joshua could add testosterone to his plays. A living Christopher Michael may have lacked the patience for living room theatricals and ignored his nerdy sister in public. I might have asked him to keep away. I could have eaten my school lunches with Jennifer, but I chose not to, and Marcy and Bobby didn't exist for each other within three blocks of school. In an absence of sweating, opinionated proof, Christopher Michael could be whatever we needed. Everyone in my family must expect a different Christopher Michael to greet us inside the pearly gates. Jennifer's Christopher Michael might have my small ears but larger eyes, and Jennifer's own passion for roaming in the woods. Rebecca's might have my nose but higher cheekbones. He'd enjoy reality TV and picnics in the park. Joshua's Christopher Michael might share his gene for premature balding and his obsessive interest in obscure European bands. My dad never mentions his unearthly child, but I'd bet his version would fish for bluegill, catfish, and trout with more enthusiasm than his living kids could muster. My mom's version might be an athlete to make up for her wimpy brood. We can shape Christopher Michael in our minds like a just-met potential lover, giving him traits that create the ideal companion for ourselves. And unlike the lover, he can't disappoint us by being just who he is, since we never see him at all. Recently, I confessed these brotherly ruminations to a friend. I lowered my voice to a whisper, though my mother was 200 miles away. "I'm afraid my mom will get to heaven and look for Christopher Michael, and he'll be a girl." My friend laughed. "He's a man of faith, but not the kind to have a divine revelation on the way to the mailbox. I think if your mother makes it that far, makes it to heaven and finds her child, you don't have anything to worry about. You're right, I said, trying to laugh too. I realized then how small my doubts were, but this logic couldn't quell my worries. I believe my mother's going to heaven, and I believe in my mother, even if these two beliefs sometimes amount to the same thing. I'm not worried about my mother's faith. I worry my mother won't find the person she's expecting, and I fear the revelation will cause her pain. Still, our Christopher Michael visions have their earthly consolations, and earth is where we need the consoling. In heaven, Marcy will have her mansion, her parents, her big sister. We know at least know for certain that Joy is a girl. On earth, Marcy's had the standard quiverful of terrestrial heartache. Her father had a heart attack, lost his leg, and died. Her mother went crazy, went blind, and died. Her parents got divorced. Her own marriage is sometimes rocky. She'd planned to go back to work when Joshua started kindergarten, but her poor health has trapped her at home. Aside from her husband and four living children, my mother doesn't have any close friends. As for the earthbound children, we're all okay, but we're surrounded by earthly temptations. My mother agonizes over sex, porn, alcohol, weed, yoga, Harry Potter, high-caffeine espresso. It must comfort her to have one child safely across heaven's finish line. And so I'll cherish my ghost brother, and I'll let him be whatever I wish for. When Joshua smokes Marlboro Reds and locks himself in his room, blasting music I can't stand, I can imagine up a brother I can talk to. My Christopher Michael mails me funny letters, rescues me when I drive into ditches, and laughs with me over David Copperfield. And I imagine Joy as the friend my mother still needs. My mom still sees her brothers at Christmas parties, at the bedsides of dying relatives, at unexpected graduations. They love each other but have little in common. But my Joy visits my mom every week to watch Fred Astaire tap dance or Bing Crosby croon. After the movie, the women discuss Republican politics over herbal tea and trade recipes for potato soup and fudge. All right, and this is a recent essay after my book that's in brevity right now called 10 Years Ago. Senior year, a fundamentalist Baptist high school. One of those times, frequent and interminable, when the teachers ran out of lesson plans and gave us time to talk. I was reading a novel because I'd run out of homework. The classroom chatter softened for a moment, and I heard a nasal twang four plastic chairs away. I stared at my book without seeing and focused my body on listening. Besides the nasal twang, Nick had basketball muscles, messy gelled hair, bright blue eyes, and I thought then the soul of a poet. Since I adored him, I believed our destinies were linked. Any word he said might affect me. Nick's voice floated across the desks and sweaters as a wordless dragonfly whine, but I caught one complete sentence. "Yeah, that happened 10 years ago, he said, his voice loud and serious. Those years sounded important, worth a boast. I looked up and saw he was talking to Heather. She'd slipped from her assigned seat in front of me into the seat in front of him. The seat beside Nick was empty, but the seat in front allowed her to twist around and drape her arms and breasts across his desk. 10 years ago, huh? Heather said, leaning her lavender dress closer. Nick grinned and spoke again, but I'd quit listening. I quit wishing I was the kind of girl who never read novels and rested my breasts on Nick's desk. I felt as important as the girls in my class who got up at 5 to curl their hair, the boys who thought too often about their shoes. 10 years ago, we were old enough to say it. Like our teachers, like our parents, we could toss off a decade when telling a story. Oh, that was 10 years ago now. Never mind that 10 years ago, downstairs in the same brick building, I'd kept caterpillars in my desk tissue box and fed them leaves and crumbs from my sandwich. Nick had sported a haircut we called a spike, short on the sides and topped with towering gelled sticks. After he'd sweated his hair flat at recess, he'd slipped into the boys' restroom to add more gel. My mom says my hair makes me look like a rock star, he'd said, flashing a half-baby teeth grin. 10 years ago, I hadn't met Heather, but my mom had seen her once in a grocery store checkout line. Heather's father, a short man in a professionally pressed white shirt, had pushed the shopping cart, and Heather, all hair bows and lace, had stood beside him, her fingers locked in the side of the cart. She'd removed one hand and pointed at a roll of powdered donuts, and her father had slapped her. But the reality of our decade was irrelevant. We were 18, with 10 remembered years behind us, and to me this felt like the definition of adulthood. The bell rang, and I hurried past my classmates and downstairs for a most significant social interaction of the day. My third grade brother met me between my classes at the little boy's bathroom. "Hi, Sir Buff," Joshua yelled, his hazel eyes big with surprise, as if we'd both happened by. Then he told me the kindergartners had played in the urinals that morning, and the elderly janitor had chased them with a mop. Running back upstairs, sliding into another plastic chair for another class, I couldn't imagine how it would feel even to speak of 20 years ago, when Nick would be too fat to look like a Christian rock star, but he'd be one, preaching the evils of Christmas trees from his Facebook pulpit. When Heather would be divorced with four cats, sewing her own clothing and brewing laundry detergent. when I'd sometimes run short on my own lesson plans, and my little brother would be dead. At 18, life was as light, changeable, and full of possibility as the dolls I'd cut from notebook paper at 8. Add crayon green scrubs and a stethoscope, and I'd be a doctor. Add a couple of paper kids, and I'd be a mom. I didn't know yet that years had weight. I could carry my past behind me like a kite, each moment adding ribbons to my string. Anyone have any questions about putting a book together, or the job market, or anything? So I started a lot of this actually here.
I mean, I guess how much of this was your thesis from here?
Let me see. I think 1, 2, 3. I think about 5 essays. So, and I wrote, I guess, about like 10 more after that. So I think I threw out half my thesis and kept half of it. Yes.
How long was the revision process once you got the book accepted? Like, from when it got accepted to be published to when it was, like, out?
They told me, I think, that they were thinking about taking it in March of 2012, and then they called me in, like, early September of 2012 and told me about that I had a contract, and then they'd actually wanted it in December. But my brother had just passed away, and I told them that wasn't possible, so they gave me until, like, I think March of the next year. So they wanted it in about, actually, in a couple of months, and then they gave me a few extra months. So they ended up wanting it in 5 months. So, I mean, I told them it was done when I wrote my letter, and that's kind of a lie. Like, I had one 25-page essay I hadn't written yet, and I knew I needed to write. And it was, like, one that took on, like, the issue of my faith directly, because I'd had people tell me that before, that they felt like that was something I was sort of just skirting around, and that was true. And I knew that I finally had to write that essay. So I thought, if someone says they want the book, I'll write the essay really quickly. And that is what I had to do. So I had to, like, pound out 25 pages in 2 weeks. So anyway, because I told them, can I have just, like, a little bit of time just to touch it up? You know, So 2 weeks, I still had to write that new 25-page essay. So then they believed me that it was done, and they wanted it right away. So it wasn't like, and then they did suggest some changes over those few months. Like, they had some, they wanted to change the order to make it more narrative. And then they also, because I have a lot of repeating characters in the essays, they wanted, it needed, each one needed to read, like, you know, I needed to not reintroduce people. So that was an issue I had to fix. They wanted me to, like, complicate the racial issue in Huntington. So they had, like, gave me, like, a little list of things to do, and then they wanted that done in just a few months. And then it was out after I turned it in. It was out, like, so it was December that I gave them. I think it was, yeah, so I gave it, so it was August. I think I'm screwing up the timeline. So August, they called me and I had the contract. They wanted it, like, in, like, a couple of months, and then they gave me until December. So then I gave it to them in December, like, a completely revised draft, and then I worked on proofs, and then this year in November it finally came out. Published. So, I mean, a lot of opportunities opened up immediately, which has been nice, but, so that's when I found, like, more success, like, with just having a book published with the short-term jobs. I did get some interviews for tenure-track jobs right away, but I, just, like, having just been, an MFA student, and I had a fellowship for a year, but then I was an adjunct after that, I found that I felt more prepared, and I think it'd be different for different people, but, like, for a short-term position, so I'm a writer-in-residence at Earlham College right now. And I found that was kind of the thing to apply for zillions of, like, right out of the book situation, like, is those shorter-term jobs, like, ones that, like, you're replacing someone who's gone temporarily, or it's just for a couple of years, so. And then now I've had, like, so then I've been there for 1 year, and so then I've been doing more tenure-track job interviews, like, at much better places than after that. So then I've got another year. If nothing comes through this year, I've got another year as a writer-in-residence. Yes.
In the last piece you read, you used the image of the kite and adding ribbons to the kite, and I really like that. And it made me think of Kite String, the last essay in your book, which was probably my favorite one in the whole book, and I really liked how you addressed the issue of, you know, your family coming to terms with discovering that your uncle was an alcoholic and was dying from it. And I guess, and you don't have to answer this too personally if you don't want to, but I guess I'm curious how your family has received your book, and maybe you can share some of their thoughts about it.
Okay. Yeah, well, my dad, who had the alcoholic brother, he was actually really happy that I wrote about him. Like, he, like, that particular essay meant a great deal to him, and he actually sent it to my uncle's, like, email address, like, after he died. Like, it just, like, kind of, like, as a way of, like, talking to him. And so, I mean, that one, so my dad's actually been really supportive. My mother won't allow a copy of the book in the house, like, so, like, literally, so it is. So that's actually been a little bit difficult, but, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, she loves me, so it's not like it's ruined our relationship. But, no, it has been a bit of a difficult thing, but mostly because of my mother. I honestly don't know. I think some of my, and actually, I got off of Facebook, and one reason was trying to stave off family members finding out and causing, and then my mother still got called. So it was just like, you know, it still was going to happen. So, yes.
Does she at least like the biblically rooted title?
I think no. I think when she, there's just no way she's going to be happy about anything. Yeah, when she says shake terribly the earth, you'd sound like, it sounds like it's like curse words or like snakes or something. So I don't know.
I had a question. Oh, just about your work. What relationship, if any, do imagination and faith have with each other in your writing?
Well, I would say quite a bit. I mean, I think you could definitely tell that from even the piece that I read with Ghost Siblings, because there's always, like, since heaven isn't something you can see, it's like this realm that you're living to try, you know, to cross into. So I always had a very, very distinct and vivid idea of what heaven would be like. So I think there's definitely a huge connection with that. And that's something that I like exploring in my writing, like these places that you can kind of like make very vivid and then describe, but aren't places that you've seen.
I mean, I was going to ask you about the job search. When you've gone for interviews, let's say phone interviews or MLA or AWP or campus, what have been some of the more surprising things that have happened, like questions that they've asked or things that they've expected you to do? Or
okay. I think my very first interview, I was kind of taken aback by them asking me to define creative nonfiction. And that and I found that always happens. Like, even, like, I just did an on-campus interview at the University of Alabama, and I gave a reading, and then one of the questions that they asked me was, what does creative nonfiction mean for you? And the thing is, that is actually a loaded question, because it isn't just, they want to know if your definition of creative nonfiction, if you're in this field, fits with theirs. Because, like, especially at Alabama, I knew I could not mention truth. I had to talk completely outside of truth, because they don't really believe in truth and creative nonfiction there. And I, like, and they're very, very fluid in what the genres mean. So I talked to them about, and I think that was something that had helped me, like, move to the next level with that job, was because I'm teaching a class right now where it's, like, trying to work towards a definition of creative nonfiction, like, that has nothing to do with truth. So I talked to them about some things that my students had kind of showed me. So I ended up, like the way time is used in creative nonfiction, which is totally different than fiction, like the level of detail, like there's certain things about the voice. So I talked about those sorts of things. So it isn't, it's actually, I've been working, I feel like I'm constantly mentally revising what is creative nonfiction. And I have to, like, read what they seem to think it is on their job website too, because sometimes it can be totally different things. So sometimes really it's journalism. And if their idea of what creative nonfiction is radically different than mine, I sometimes decide I'm not even sure I want to apply for a job. Sometimes it's advanced composition. I mean, it's rhetoric is what it is. So sometimes I end up finding myself talking about, oh, I've actually taught composition and rhetoric for a long time, because I think they find that even more interesting than my writing, because that's really what they're kind of wanting. So I think that's a kind of surprising thing. One thing that sort of threw me for a loop in this last round of MLA was, because these were both for tenure track jobs, they wanted to know, because I have a project, my next creative nonfiction project that I'm working on and that I can talk about very well. So then they were like, thinking far, far, far in the future, what other books are you going to write? And I'm like, ah, you know, and I was just like, so I'm just like coming up with the weirdest crap. And it's just like, I don't know. And so that was frightening. So I think, definitely you have to be able to pitch your next book, because they always ask me that, like, what is your next book? And you have to have it down to a really good pitch of what it's going to be, because they explain to you over and over again, like, you know that this book you wrote helps you get this job, but it will not count for tenure. Like, they say that over and over again. And I'm like, yes, I understand that. And they're like, you have to write another book. And I'm like, I know. And so they're like, so then they explain to you. So, you know, so then they ask you, what is your book? And then they want to know, looking down the road. So that is something. And sometimes I've been asked, like, how do you feel about sci-fi? I got asked that in an interview recently, which I didn't find had anything to do with my field. But, I mean, it can be just... It could really be about anything. I did find that practicing quite a bit helped. Like, I would have my sister or a friend just ask me questions. So Marianne actually gave me a very helpful list of hypothetical questions for interviews, and then I just, like, talked through them. Like, I would go to a coffee shop, and then I would just, like, pitch my questions over and over again. And I found that it's sort of like writing a paragraph in an academic paper or, like, writing a very short academic paper. It's like you need to, like, make a very tight, clear statement of what it is, of what the answer is, then expound with one or two very good examples, and then close it. Like, and it's so, and that's really important when you're practicing for interviews. Yes.
How was it to write after going through 3 years of workshop?
Was oh, like
workshop.
When I was,
yeah. How
alone?
Was that for you?
It wasn't as scary as you might think. I think so. I mean, I had it would help to me that because I know I had some friends that. Said they couldn't even write for like a year after they were done. Like some people, like just said, like there's this exhaustion level that can come. So I didn't write for a summer after I quit, after the MFA program. But I find that I almost never write in the summer, which is just kind of an odd thing about me. But I think it helped that I had the fellowship because I felt like I'm here for this fellowship. I absolutely have to write constantly. So I did. But I also found that losing that support network, like you get the MFA and you graduate because you're done. Like, you know, and you can, it's true, like you're really ready. You don't need to have all those opinions anymore. And then you'll have at that point, like the two people, you know, that really gave you the best feedback, you know, and you can, if you need an opinion, you can get it from them.